Hi, this is Herb Kressel, editor of Radiology, and today, as part of the Radiology Select volume on the evaluation of lung nodules, we'll be speaking with the authors of the Fleischner guidelines for lung nodules and the authors of a paper published in Radiology evaluating the compliance with the guidelines for evaluation of nodules. And then, Dr. Nadich, you're in two categories because we also have you as the author on a review article on the semi-solid pulmonary nodules and the recommendation for interim guidelines that you published in Radiology in 2009. So hopefully we'll bring all of this up to date. Now let me introduce our panel. First, Dr. Alex Banquier, who is Associate Professor of Radiology at Beth Israel Deaconess and Harvard Medical School, and our Deputy Editor for Thoracic Imaging, Deputy Editor of our journal, Radiology. And Dr. Banquier is also one of the guest editors for this Radiology Select volumes. Welcome, Dr. Banquier. And next, Dr. Heber McMahon, Professor of Radiology at the University of Chicago and Director of the Section of Thoracic Imaging. As I mentioned, Dr. McMahon is one of the original authors on the Fleischner guidelines. Welcome, Dr. McMahon.
Thank you.
And next, we have Dr. David Nadich, bon vivant and professor of radiology at New York University. He needs no further introduction, but welcome to our panel, Dr. Nadich.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay. And rounding out the panel, my good friend and colleague, Dr. Ron Eisenberg, Associate Professor of Radiology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Harvard Medical School, and a member of the Section of Thoracic Imaging at Beth Israel Deaconess. Thanks for joining us, Ron.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, let's begin. And Alex, perhaps you can tell us why you and the other guest editors of this volume decided to create a section on the guidelines.
Thank you, Herb. I believe the main reason, to state it very boldly and very briefly, is the enormous interest of the public in this topic. Wherever you go out into the radiology community at large, people know these guidelines, people discuss these guidelines, people debate about these guidelines. There is not only a need for the guidelines per se, but also a need for discussion about them. And I think the clearest the clearest sign of that is that, for example, the original guidelines for the management of pulmonary nodules that was issued several years ago is still the most downloaded article of radiology. So people are tremendously interested into this topic, and we will go probably into details along the discussion, but I think the general interest of the radiology community at large in this issue of how to manage pulmonary nodules deserves an own chapter about guidelines.
Sure. Dr. McMahon, perhaps you can kind of go back. The original guidelines were published in 2005, and what actually prompted the creation of the Fleischner Society guidelines for the management of pulmonary nodules? Why did you all decide to do this?
Well, I think we perceived an urgent need to create some guidelines in this situation because there was a practical disconnect between what was happening in clinical practice and what the official guidelines at the time stated. And the only existing guidelines really that applied to pulmonary nodules were those from the American College of Chest Physicians. And the existing guidelines up until 2005 stated that all nodules needed to be followed at regular intervals, regardless of size. Mm-hmm. There was no distinction between large and small nodules. So we felt that since clearly based on the data coming out of the screening programs at the time, that risk was related to size, among other things, that it would be helpful to sort of stratify the risk and produce new guidelines based on the perceived risk in each category.
Now, what was the process that the original writing group used to establish these guidelines? Was it sort of consensus? Was there a meta-analysis done? How were these actually formulated? Dr. Nadich?
Well, actually, I would defer to Heber on that particular question because he was the prime first author for that, so perhaps he would be able to answer that question more intelligently than I.
All right. Well, the process basically was an initial series of meetings between a group within the Fleischner Society that represented pulmonary radiologists and physicians. We started with, of course, a review of the literature. We had numerous conference calls, and it was really after that a matter of consensus that there was not a great deal, and there still is not a great deal of hard data, or certainly as much as we would like, to inform the guidelines. But we felt that this was at least a starting point, and you know, despite our apprehension in that perhaps some of these guidelines didn't have as solid a basis as we would like in the literature, they've been extremely well received. So I think it was a worthwhile effort.
So, yeah, that. Why do you think there continue to be among the most downloaded articles in radiology?
Well, let me take over for a second then, because I think what Heber was talking about also, and I'm perhaps getting ahead of myself a little bit, is going to also pertain to the new set of guidelines that hopefully will be emerging from the Fleischner Society in the near future. So the process clearly has the advantage coming from the Fleischner Society, as Heber said, of being a process that involves all different disciplines that have interest in the problem of pulmonary medicine, specifically in this case nodules. So it's surgeons and pulmonologists and oncologists and radiologists and so forth. So I think why the Fleischner Society was well positioned to try to come up with guidelines was in fact that it is so characteristically involves so many different disciplines. As for the reason why, I think part of it is just technological. As our scanners have gotten faster and faster, and as CT has become more and more general radiology, it's pretty much become, in a lot of important ways, akin to a chest radiograph in terms of its utility. And since our ability to detect tiny changes in the lungs on CT has gotten better and better, not surprisingly, one of the urgent problems that's, you know, become even more urgent with time is this problem detecting small abnormalities in the lungs. So although I would agree with Heber that we don't necessarily function from the vantage point of hard evidence from, you know, multiple trials that were blinded and so forth, the idea of coming up with guidelines at this particular point in time and continuing to come up with guidelines still, I think, remains an urgent problem for virtually anyone interested in thoracic disease.
Now, did the society, Dr. McMahon, did it formally vote on the guidelines? Was there a commitment by the society members that they would use or follow the guidelines, or are these meant really to be an educational offering?
Yes, there was formal consensus at a meeting of the Fleischner Society, and there was eventually complete agreement on the guidelines. I believe that they are being used by certainly the large majority of the members, though all of the members, of course, are not radiologists.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Now, Dr. Eisenberg, you and Dr. Banquier took a look at the issue of compliance with these guidelines, surveying 834 radiologists, presumably from more than just the United States. And why did you decide to do that?
Well, we teach the Fleischner guidelines from the first day that someone comes into chest radiology. and we just wanted to find out whether everyone was aware of these, whether they used these in their practices, and whether they would be able to answer a series of three questions based on the guidelines.
And what did you find?
Well, we found that there was a very good awareness of almost 80% of the guidelines, and almost 60% put them into their practice, some sort of written protocols. But when we actually gave them three scenarios based on the guidelines, we were quite surprised that the simplest one had only 60% compliance with the guidelines, where the other two, the compliance was between 35% and 40%.
So how do you put this together? I mean, people are downloading this like crazy, so presumably they should know the content, but yet they're not using them regularly. What was your take on this, Alex?
I was a little surprised about the percentage and about the magnitude of the phenomenon, but I was not at all surprised about the phenomenon per se. I think it's important to remember that these are guidelines. These are not the Ten Commandments, and they are not written in stone, but they are a suggestion, a proposal coming from an expert group, and based on the available evidence, even if this available evidence is not very robust. Mm-hmm. So I think people, you know, interpreting these guidelines in their own clinical context and according to the clinical scenarios they face is in fact something that can be expected and anticipated, and probably also is something good, okay? So that people use these guidelines in general terms, but adapt them to the specific needs of the clinical situations they face.
Let me take this a little further, and I'll start with Dr. McMahon, and I'll go around the table. So this is a two-part question. The first part is, when you drafted them, what was your concept as to sort of how applicable and what percentage of situations should you be able to use them? And then at your own institution, what's your estimate as to how often they're actually used?
I think when we drafted the guidelines, we emphasized, first of all, as Alex stated, that they were guidelines, not rules, and that it's quite appropriate to modify them in individual cases, depending on, among other things, the patient's personal preference for more aggressive mm-hmm. follow-up or less, as the case may be. In our own institution, I would say that we follow them, and it's part of our core reading for the residents when they rotate through the section, mm-hmm. and of course we have the table posted on a website, but having said that, we do modify it quite frequently in individual cases. So I agree that I think that the fact that people are widely aware of them is the important mm-hmm. thing. The fact that they didn't get exactly the right answer, as it were, in particular cases may be less important, but I think that the recommendations for follow-up are being influenced by the guidelines right. in the sense that we're using less aggressive and less frequent follow-up
sure.
than we were doing before.
And would you think that 60% compliance would be sort of where you would have expected it to wind up?
You know, I wouldn't put too much emphasis on that mm-hmm. exact question because, again, I don't know how important that number is. I would have hoped it would have been a bit higher if mm-hmm. people went to the trouble of answering the questions and had the guidelines available, but I can't explain the number, I must say.
Okay, and David, what's your sense? How often is this used at NYU and Bellevue?
Well, certainly everyone's aware of them. Not everybody uses them, but I think to step back for a second, first of all, I think that the numbers are actually very optimistic numbers. I mean, I think those are actually quite high numbers mm-hmm. For a set of guidelines that involve a very fundamental change in the way people think. And I think one of the aspects of these guidelines that hasn't been adequately recognized is that they really do call for stepping back from what has traditionally been the diagnosis of a really dread disease, which is lung cancer. Mm-hmm. And so the notion has always been that really more aggressive follow-up, more aggressive concern for the evolution of these lesions into cancers has always dominated most people's thinking. These guidelines really step back quite a bit from that, even including not following lesions at all. And mm-hmm. I think that really is a kind of a remarkable thing about the guidelines. So to the extent that they've gotten as well known and that there are, in fact, as many people who not only are aware of them but follow them, is very impressive. I think there's probably a whole lot of reasons why people don't follow them. Mm-hmm. I think one of them is just what I said, that even though they're aware of the guidelines, they may even agree with the guidelines, that it's very difficult nonetheless to break that pattern and habit of thinking about how you would be exposed if it turned out that you ignored something or took too long getting around to re-imaging something that turned out to be a cancer. And I think that people were set up for that. If you go back to the original guidelines that were promulgated for lung cancer screening, for example, it was just an enormous number of follow-up scans taken very quickly. So I think that's part of the reason. I think psychologically there are reasons why people just can't abide by the idea of stepping back and doing less as opposed to more. I think that sense of well-being, if you will, or finding that particular zone of comfort mm-hmm. Is part of the rationale for why people don't use these, even if they think that they're a good idea. Well, and then one other wrinkle, just to throw it in, which is I'd be really curious to know how many people are aware of these guidelines but don't follow them because the pulmonologists or the people who are referring these cases to us don't want to accept them either for very similar reasons to the ones mm-hmm. I've just stated.
Well, that's an interesting question. Alex, do you have any experience with this or any information on sort of reluctance of chest physicians to accept these?
I don't have information for the general context. I have just made the experience that at our institution, both the thoracic surgeons and the pulmonologists have accepted this on a quite broad basis. We try also to propagate these guidelines. For example, on our reports, we have, when we give a recommendation according to the guidelines, we have the table from the guidelines mm-hmm. printed with explanations so that the familiarity of the referring physicians increases. But the general acceptance has been quite high, and even if we discourage follow-up in a particular patient, most clinicians would follow that recommendation.
David, going back to your comments, the I think the question that comes to mind, and it sort of I alluded to this earlier, if you take out the sort of psychological and social aspects of this, how often would they actually be the right way to practice without exception, do you think?
Well, I think the honest answer to that would be a prospective study that validated the guidelines, which is something that I think is actually really important. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you, I think, and I don't want to speak for everybody, but in our experience, following these guidelines, I think, has proven to be clinically a valid way of monitoring, following these patients. I don't think that we have, using these guidelines, varied really very much from what has proven, at least in our place, to be good clinical practice. So, in the absence of some kind of prospective double-blind or some other equivalent type of validation study, just based on our now 6 years experience using these, I think that we've actually been very successful in terms of how we've managed clinically the caseload that we've been confronted with.
I see. And the next thing is, David, this kind of goes to this review article that you published in our journal on the semi-solid pulmonary nodules. And the question is, what is the half-life of these guidelines? When should they be revised? And what should the process for that be? I gather that you're in the middle of revising them. And so how was this decision made? Perhaps we should start with Dr. McMahon on this one.
Well, I think in this case, I probably should defer to Dr. Nadege.
So much for my abilities as a moderator. Yes, go ahead.
David.
Oh, okay. Back to me. Well, the one aspect of the new guidelines is just extremely simple to explain, which is that the initial guidelines really focused on solid lung nodules. They left out an entire category of nodules that, again, going back to our technology, have become more and more commonplace for us to identify in routine practice, which are these some solid or semi-solid, sub or semi-solid nodules. And their natural history, it really is quite different from solid lesions. So the rationale for developing a new set of guidelines at this time really, I think, is a natural evolution from the original guidelines. And I think that the process, just to reiterate what Heber said before, is almost identical in terms of how these guidelines are being propagated, how the Fleischmann Society is reviewing them, and the entire process for how ultimately these will be submitted for publication. In terms of the time frame for how often to review these, you know, I think the 5 years or 6 years that have passed from the original guidelines to now is not an unreasonable number. I don't know that there is an actual, you know, hard piece of evidence to suggest what a time frame would be. I think clearly with the, you know, avalanche of articles and papers that are published on this subject, timely review of those and timely revision of these guidelines is obviously important. But I'm not sure that we need to take its temperature every 6 months. I mean, I think we really need to have a sense of how well they are, you know, used, whether or not they are accepted, before we can really start talking about then validating them in any kind of scientific fashion.
Well, was there any thought to sort of tacking on a side study to the National Lung Cancer Screening Study that would look at the guidelines and their applications? Did anyone think about that or pursue that, to your knowledge?
I think one of the disappointing things about the National Lung Screening Trial at this point, and I say disappointing in quotes, is that we haven't gotten some of the really important data that we know they have,
right,
in terms of characterizing the kinds of lesions that they actually biopsied, the kinds of lesions that they actually ended up resecting. I mean, that to me is one of the great you know, pieces of information for which NLST is going to be hugely helpful and influential in terms of how we think about how to handle all these lesions based on the size of that study, but we don't have that data yet from them.
Going back to you, Dr. Eisenberg, was there any evidence in the study that you did that was sort of confusion about the semi-solid nodules that was affecting compliance?
We did not get involved with that at all, but I did want to add two clarifying things relating to a previous question that you have. First of all, in our study, we found that there was a statistically significant improvement in those people who had 5 years or less of experience in practice, which would mean that it really is more difficult for experienced radiologists, perhaps, to change the practice that they've had over many, many years. And the other thing was that our compliance rate was, when you compare it to other guidelines, really wasn't that bad. The American Thoracic Society did a study on the treatment of a community-acquired pneumonia. They had a similar 80% of respondents being aware of the guidelines and about 50% being influenced by them, but only 20% said they actually used them. So actually, we did better.
Well, it's kind of interesting, of course. And the flip side, the other hand, is that we're sort of entering an era where we're looking for error reduction and enhanced quality of medical practice. And, you know, one of the tenets of that is that this is achieved by reducing practice variability. So it seems to me that, you know, it may be that this compliance level is appropriate for the world that we've been living in, but I'm not sure that it's appropriate for the world that we're moving into, particularly as the problem is so pressing. So
that's all the more reason, though, why we should have guidelines.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. The thing I'd like to ask everyone on the panel is, do you think these should be kind of advanced through the college? You know, there's a lot of the college through the research, through its efforts does affect practice modes considerably, and they establish those. Has there been any thought given to, with this revised set, to have them endorsed by the college?
Let me say something about that. I think one of the dangers of guidelines is that if everybody starts promulgating their own, then what you end up with is a great deal of confusion. So it's a double-edged sword. To the extent that you could get some really major organizations to agree upon guidelines, that would be an enormously important and I think very helpful advantage. To the extent, though, that you have differences of opinion between various guidelines, that's actually a prescription for a real problem. To that extent, I will tell you that the Fleischner guidelines really did influence the American College of Chest Physician guidelines, which for all intents and purposes incorporated the Fleischner guidelines. And the American College of Chest Physicians is now in the process of also revising and rethinking its guidelines as part of its ongoing revision of lung cancer evaluation. And I think, again, there's a very acute consciousness on their part that they need to coordinate with what the Fleischner Society is going to come out with. So to the extent that the ACR would be a much bigger voice, I think it would be great. But I would be a little bit concerned that there's some kind of uniformity of opinion, if it's at all possible. And that brings back the issue of how good is the science. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to remain problematic for a while.
Ron, any thoughts about this? Do you think the guidelines should sort of be endorsed and promulgated through sort of organizations that are sort of dealing with these general practice issues?
I think it's a very reasonable approach. The only caveat is that when there are guidelines, there is a problem potentially for somebody who chooses not to follow those guidelines. And this can result in possible medical legal issues, which really have to be thought out as well. You don't want to make somebody liable to a suit simply because they decided that the guidelines were not appropriate in a certain setting, and they would be then responsible for proving to a trier of fact that their approach was the better one.
I think it's a fascinating question. I think everyone should pitch in on that. Is anyone aware of court cases or any kind of precedent that's been established regarding the Fleischner guidelines in terms of malpractice?
I'm not aware of that, but it is an important issue, and I think it works the other way too. And I think personally one of the reasons the guidelines have been so popular and have been downloaded so often perhaps is that radiologists feel that they do afford a level of protection in cases where they choose not to follow a very small nodule or to follow less frequently than would have been the tradition before. So, you know, I think it can be helpful from that point of view also. And as far as it being a danger when one doesn't follow them, I think we've tried to emphasize, and we'll emphasize again, that as was said up front, these are guidelines, these are not rules, and they're appropriately used judiciously depending on the clinical context. So I don't think it should be an issue for people to choose to diverge from the guidelines, provided they do so consciously and rationally.
Sure. My thought, Ron, is that the college is pretty careful in the wording so that it doesn't really sort of mandate that you abandon individual judgment in a certain circumstance. And lots of organizations, in terms of, you know, when they're looking at compliance, they establish a metric for what percentage of compliance would be expected for something like this. So I think there is a way to do this that would not provide legal jeopardy. And I personally, I sort of agree with Dr. McMahon that I think a lot of people have comfort in these guidelines and that it kind of protects them, particularly where your sort of your recommendations go against the popular psychology.
Well, in that regard, the fact that you printed or published a paper on compliance showing that not everybody complies with them also feeds into that as well, right?
Yes. Well, this has been a great discussion, and we're sort of running out of time. So I want to thank all of our panel for participating, and thank you again for the work you've submitted to Radiology, and we look forward to the updated guidelines. When will these be available?
Good question. Gentlemen, I think we have two pertinent answers. You guys even look at it yet? Take it to either turn you want, Heber or Alex or either. No, seriously. I mean, I can tell you where we're at. I mean, there has been a kind of a very preliminary final draft been drawn up, which now resides in the bosom of the other two people on this conference call.
Okay.
Oh, I'm thinking somewhere around the next month to 2 months, I think.
Yeah, that's good.
We'll be able to actually give you a better answer to that question.
Oh, just in 2 months we'll have an answer. Okay, well, our readers look forward to that, and thank you all very much for participating.
Thank you.
And you guys could get